Ali Bedad, the director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies. And on behalf of my colleagues at the center, I would like to welcome you all to this Zoom conference on politics and practices of resistance in the Middle East. This conference has been made possible in partnership with MESA's Global Academy, which, as many of you know, is an interdisciplinary initiative to sustain central research collaborations and knowledge production among MENA-focused scholars from the region and their counterparts outside the region. We are delighted to be a partner of this great project, and I would like to thank my very dear colleague, Professor Asla Bali, for her vision and leadership role in making this program possible and for making us a partner. Asla, as many of you know, is an incredible scholar and academic leader with deep commitment to human rights and civil rights, and we are truly grateful to have her as a colleague at the CNES. I also wish to thank Mimi Kirk, the program manager of the Global Academy, as well as our own program manager, Joanna Romero, and program coordinator, Christian Rodriguez, for their logistical help and support. Finally, I wish to give special thanks to our colleague, Jan Achiksuz, for his incredible work in planning and organizing of this conference. Without his help, this would have been a much more challenging task to organize this conference. Now, before I turn the virtual podium to my colleague Asla, I would like to say a few words about CNES for those of you who may not be familiar with the work we do. CNES is a research hub where over 100 faculty from humanities, social sciences, arts, and the law school collaborate in a variety of research and pedagogical projects. Founded in 1957, it is one of the oldest and most distinguished U.S. centers for interdisciplinary research on the MENA region. We provide a forum for the exchange of ideas and the dissemination of information within and beyond the campus, offering cutting-edge research and fresh perspectives on the challenges and cultural richness of the Middle East. The center supports graduate and undergraduate instruction in over a dozen academic departments, research by faculty, students, and visiting scholars, interchange among scholars from around the world, and vital public programming on the challenges facing the MENA region, as well as their many cultural and social achievements. Please check our website, where you will find all the events and programs of our center, as well as recorded programs from the past. Now, I would like to welcome my colleague Asla, Professor Asla Bali, to the podium.
Thank you so much, Ali, for that very generous opening statement and for all the information that you provided as well. It is my absolute pleasure to be here today. This conference has been a long time in the making. I remember our first meetings discussing the possibilities of organizing a conference with this distinguished set of scholars. And it is really a true honor for me to have been able to participate in conceptualizing this together with Jan Achiksuz. And the idea of engaging on the questions of politics and practices of resistance in the Middle East is especially timely, I think, at this moment, as we ourselves are confronting a year in which practices of resistance have been so much in evidence on the streets and in the cities of this country. There is so much that we can learn actually from grounded empirical work, qualitative work, and then analytic work addressing the ways in which people's publics of the region in the Middle East have long engaged in these practices and have long sought to subvert the very kinds of structures of systemic inequality and injustice that this country is very much enmeshed in here, but also has pervaded internationally. And so there is a terrain of subject matter that has long been the sort of central preoccupation, if you like, of people working in the social sciences, in particular on the Middle East, but that now is a bridge, much as the MESA Global Academy project itself hopes to be a bridge that enables us to really strengthen the partnerships between scholars that are based in the region and scholars that are based in North America that make the Middle East the focus of their research. So too, this conference enables us to see the bridges between the subject matter, analytic perspectives, conceptual frames, and basic empirical observations from the field that we have long grappled with in the region and its deep connections to the struggles of publics here in the United States. So it's an especially timely and important topic, and we are really blessed to have a set of scholars here who are exceptional in their capacity to shed light on these questions. I'll just say briefly one addendum to our program, which is that Sera Hakyemez will be joining us in the second panel of the conference today, which is also an enormous pleasure. We would have very much loved to have had Dr. Rukan Şengül amongst us, and we look forward to having her present in future at the Center for Near Eastern Studies. So I just second the words of my colleague, the director of the Center for Near Eastern Studies, Professor Ali Behtad, in inviting you to check our website and keep your eyes out for both Dr. Şengül's future presentation and also our broader programming, which is very rich and addresses similar topics and themes over the course of the year. But we are so fortunate to have Professor Hakyemez here as well amongst us, whose own field work is very much in the same terrain and grappling with similar issues to those that Dr. Şengül would have been addressing today. So we once again have a complete program, very much in keeping with what we had originally conceptualized for today. We're extraordinarily fortunate to have that. And with this, I want to turn the floor to my dear colleague, John Açıksöz, Professor of Anthropology here at UCLA, whose own book is an award-winning book from Mesa, which was published this past year and which received the Mernissi Award from Mesa Sacrificial Limbs. I very much commend it to your attention. But for today, Professor Açıksöz is here not to discuss his book, although I look forward to future book panels where we can engage the book here and elsewhere, but he will be opening the conference with some remarks about the theme that we'll be engaging with today. Thanks so much, Professor Açıksöz.
Thank you, Ali and Aslı, for these introductory remarks. I am also honored to be a part of this conference, and I will be basically introducing our speakers. So bear with me for a couple of minutes as I go over their remarkable achievements. So I will start by introducing our panelists and our discussant. Our first panelist is Haydar Darıcı. Haydar is a postdoctoral fellow in Kurdish studies at American University. He has a PhD in anthropology from the University of Michigan. His research focuses on youth politics of resistance in Kurdistan. His work has appeared in Turkish and English in journals, including Theory and Events, New Perspectives in Turkey, International Journal of Middle East Studies. And you have also co-authored a book with Leyla Nezi in Turkish, as well as many other publications. Unfortunately, I have a short bio that doesn't do justice to your publication history. But overall, Haydar Darıcı is a leading scholar of Kurdish youth in Turkish and Turkish Kurdistan and beyond. So that was our first speaker. And our second speaker is Sera Hakyemez, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota. Sera holds a PhD in anthropology from Johns Hopkins University. Based on her archival and ethnographic research on terror trials in Diyarbakir, Turkey, her dissertation, Lives and Times of Militancy, examines what the political looks like within the space of law, where Turkey resumes its war of terror against the Kurdish movement through myriad judicial and penitentiary technologies. Based on this dissertation, Dr. Hakyemez currently works on a book project, Laws of Terror, Becoming Political in Criminal Courts, which approaches the political vulnerability of Kurds before the law as generative of a grammar of defense that is at once aspirational, corporal, and collective. Laws of Terror argues that the vague and arbitrary execution of anti-terror laws not only fail to discipline Kurdish revolutionaries into citizen subjects, but also gives birth to an intimate space in which the terror suspects work together to redraw the lines between hope and despair, politics and criminality, and heroism and treason. Hakyemez's research has been awarded by the American Council of Learned Societies, National Science Foundation, and Wenner Graham Foundation. Her publications in peer-reviewed journals and opinion pieces draw on the literature on ordinary ethics, political community, and human rights to examine the implications of law and violence in Turkey's war on war of terror. And our discussant is Melissa Bilal, also from UCLA. Melissa Bilal is Distinguished Research Fellow at UCLA Center for Near East Studies and also a lecturer in the Department of Ethnomusicology. She previously taught at the University of Chicago, Columbia University, Boğaziçi University, and American University of Armenia, where she still serves as a member of the core team developing the gender studies program. Dr. Bilal received her BA and MA degrees in sociology at Boğaziçi University and earned her PhD in music from the University of Chicago. She was a Mellon postdoctoral teaching fellow in music at Columbia University and postdoctoral research fellow at the Orient Institute Istanbul. She has published numerous pieces in journals, including Dialectical Anthropology, New Perspectives on Turkey. She is right now currently co-authoring a book on Armenian feminism, which is under contract with the Stanford University Press, co-authored with Lerna Ekmekçioğlu. And she has numerous other publications in Turkish and English. But welcome to our panelists and our discussants.
Okay. My presentation is about revolutionary youth politics in Cizre, a Kurdish town near Turkey's border with Iraq and Syria. I will focus on the transformation of this youth struggle from insurrectionary protests to armed self-defense in the context of the formation of self-governance in Kurdistan. I will argue that this transformation occurred through a fetishistic mechanism by which the youth became both the locus and agents of the structuring of political desire. Cizre youth protested almost every day from sunset to sunrise, often for no apparent reason at all. This insurrectionary practice was premised on clashing with the police and disrupting daily life, a common tactic of anti-colonial struggles. To trigger police intervention, protesters would erect barricades, block roads, and chant slogans. What followed was a tit-for-tat engagement with the police. Protesters would attack the police with the ammunition they produced by repurposing mundane objects such as stones, cans, pieces of wood, empty alcohol bottles, and fireworks. Though these acts certainly made the protests seem violent, such homemade weapons couldn't damage either armored vehicles or the riot police inside. The police nonetheless retaliated to such imaginary or symbolic violence with actual violence, sometimes using live ammunition, but more often by transforming non-lethal ammunition into lethal ones. Tear gas, for instance, is meant to be fired into open areas to scatter protesters. However, the police directly targeted the bodies of protesters with the hard aluminum canisters in which tear gas is stored. Shooting protesters with these canisters would consequently wound and even kill young militants. The protests generated a political spectacle for adult residents who watched from doors left ajar or windows with a mixed sense of avowal and disavowal. The youth, aware of the spectacle of their own creation, acted as both participants and spectators of the protests. Using smartphones smuggled from Iraq, they regularly photographed and videotaped scenes of clashes to upload to social media platforms, offering immediate access to broader publics. Since images frequently appeared in mainstream Turkish print and broadcast media, if unvaryingly with a negative and scandalous tone, such a degree of visibility fashioned an image of a youth protester that people could recognize and identify with. Reaching the status of an image, Rosalind Morris argues, is the basis of political subjectivity in the age of mass media and digital circulation. Furthermore, it is also the grounds for political collectivity, especially after the displacement of political parties and labor-based organizational structures by horizontal networks of solidarity. Morris argues that protesting crowds, I quote, must become visible to themselves as the basis of necessary objectification, and they must become visible to others to elicit the recognition that will reinforce that objective status. Visibility was an ambivalent phenomenon for youth insurrectionaries. It was necessary to cultivate a sense of being political within a collectivity. Yet visibility also made the youth prone to surveillance by the police. The consequence of police surveillance in Kurdistan are perhaps more dire than in other places. When the youth were identified, they were accused of committing a terrorist crime. This has become especially the case since the Turkish police began videotaping protesters and using visual data they gathered to identify individual protesters through their clothing. Moreover, rumors of the Turkish police deploying spies to infiltrate the youth struggle abounded. I heard countless stories from my interlocutors about such spies. One of the most common tropes is of a local young woman falling in love with a police officer whose secret purpose is to use her as an informant. In one story, a young woman intentionally or unintentionally, and there are different versions, provides an officer with information about her brother, leading to his arrest. Another trope includes a person who fascinates everyone with their extensive knowledge of the Kurdish struggle, their loyalty, courage, and sacrifices, only to be revealed to be a spy. The governing idea of these stories is that appearance can be deceiving. Even more perplexing, however, is the unavoidable proximity of the enemy. Spies were often revealed to be one's family members, friends, and even comrades. This structure of expectation saturated political life in Cizre with paranoid suspicion. If spies were within the intimate circle of protesters, they would be able to recognize protesters by identifying the markers of their social identities, such as name, face, gender, body size, posture, voice, dialect, and so forth. To achieve anonymity and reduce the risk of arrest, youth protesters developed various concealment tactics, including sartorial transgression and impersonation. They were compelled to appear in public space only as someone else by assuming the attire of another gender, speaking the dialect of another tribe, and impersonating imaginative characters. So the youth did what they believed the spies were doing. They appeared as who they were not. The necessary self-objectification as the ground for political subjectivity would therefore be premised on one's appearing as another, that is, on one's non-identity. Mimetic practices of sartorial transgression and impersonation shouldn't be considered merely imperatives for the avoidance of arrest. They also indicate a desire to become another, a desire that Walter Benjamin attributes to the notion of play. In fact, the desire for self-surpassing was already embedded in youth insurrection. The youth protesters expressed absolute devotion and selflessness to the guerrillas who they sought to join. They iconicized the guerrillas as living martyrs who disowned their lives before joining the armed struggle. Therefore, joining the guerrillas meant becoming a new person. Many protesters indeed made an exist, meaning joining the guerrillas, before and during my fieldwork. Even before ascending to the mountains, this trajectory was evident in the codenames used by protesters as a tactic of concealment. It was common for them to appropriate the codenames of guerrillas that they admired. Consider Chektar, means warrior, a typical guerrilla codename, which would originally also include a second word functioning as a surname, often a place name, for instance, like Chektar Cizre, of Cizre. Protesters experience such freedom of becoming another without necessarily making a more permanent exit. One element of this experience comes from sartorial dissimulation, for which they again follow in the footsteps of the guerrillas. For instance, when temporarily assigned to Cizre, they needed to be inconspicuous and dressed in black burqas. The youth slightly modified this practice of dissimulation. For instance, women protesters wore sweaters. I forgot to show you pictures, actually. The youth slightly modified this practice of dissimulation. Women protesters wore sweaters and a type of baggy pants typically worn by men. Some women still wore skirts. focusing on more on covering their breasts with loose sweaters. In contrast, men assumed loose dresses or skirts. Thus, unlike the attire of the guerrillas, which was to make its wearer blend into the crowd, protesters instead turned themselves into a spectacle. They gave themselves to be seen by the crowd, the camera, and the police. Of significance was the revelation of the fact of concealment itself, not of the concealed content. For the police often knew from the unfitting, randomly assembled attires full of rips that the protesters were performing sartorial transgression as camouflage. This fact that they knew it incited an uncontainable desire for unmasking to reach the surface. The attire then attested to its own fabrication, fixing its wearer between visibility and invisibility. Nonetheless, the surface was originally misrecognized to be young men due to their exclusive association with protest. This led my interlocutors to speculate on how the police might have viewed female protesters wearing skirts to instead be male protesters disguised as female protesters. There were also elements of corporeal and linguistic dissimulation observable in the altered posture, gait, and speech of protesters. Speech was a personal identifier as much as a marker of a tribal affiliation, as there was a publicly recognizable speech and dialect variation across the tribes of Jizre. Able to speak multiple Kurdish dialects, protesters could adapt their speech to pretend to be a member of another tribe. Some protesters went so far as to role-play imaginary or other characters. One such character was Marcos. At first, I assumed it was a reference to Marcos of the Mexican Zapatista movement as a gesture of solidarity with political struggles elsewhere. However, it turned out that the impersonator was imagining this character to be an Armenian atheist. Another protester assumed the character known as Doctor. He used to wear one of those white doctor's coats during protests. He also found what he called a doctor's bag and stocked it with Molotov cocktails, fireworks, and blast bombs. The doctor also included first aid supplies in his bag and assisted those with minor injuries with rudimentary medical knowledge he had acquired over time. Fellow protesters and even the police from the megaphones of armored vehicles refer to this protester as doctor. That the police called the doctor by his assumed identity is an indication of their recognition of and participation in game playing. Another sign of this game playing is the negotiations between protesters and the police to take a break when they were tired or hungry. Just like at the end of the first half of a soccer game, as one protester remarked, following the break agreed to by both parties, the violent game would resume. Given that the police always remained in armored vehicles, youth protesters perceived the vehicles as their homes, as the police's homes. Over time, the protester learned to read the police officer's physical condition, emotion, and state of mind by simply observing the vehicle's movements. When the vehicle slowed down, protesters related, we know that the police are either tired or hungry. The police were like an opposing team without whom the protesters couldn't play this deadly game. For this reason, in rare cases, when the youth took to the street and erected barricades, but the police didn't show up, a protester who called the police lodged a complaint requesting police intervention in the ongoing protest. Whether or not the police responded, it can be assumed that the police were aware of the intentions behind such calls, as Jizre residents would never call on the police to intervene in a political gathering. Such protests occur in a repetitive mode. Benjamin suggests that the impulse to repetition is another fundamental quality of play, with a function that transforms a shattering experience into habit. From a semiological reading, but in a similar direction, Gregory Bateson sees in play a metacommunicative practice, detaching the signifier from its normative relation to the signified. He therefore defines play not as an action, but as a metacommunicative frame in which actions denote what they would not do in another frame. Nevertheless, both thinkers attribute a world-creating capacity to the notion of play, which gave rise to a politically mediated, deeply transcreative world of insurrection in Kurdistan. Even though its deadly consequences made it difficult to differentiate between what is play and what is not, the intensity of such politics erased ordinary life by limiting temporality to the now of insurrection. How many minutes I have?
Aydar, sorry to interrupt. Only 2 minutes left.
Only two? Oh, yes. I have. Probably I won't be able to talk about the second part then, self-defense. Time moves so fast in protest that protesters lose track of time as they clash with and run away from the police. One interlocutor once spent over 15 hours protesting before realizing he had not eaten anything the whole time. I quote, "You lose yourself. You do not care about hunger or thirst. You just focus on the corner of the street, whether the police vehicle will appear there or not." Another interlocutor couldn't even find the right words to describe his intense protest experience except to mark on what was not. There is something we call weeping. There is something we call laughing. But what is in the protest is different from emotions. He nonetheless recounted how absorbing protest moments made him distance himself from the constraints of everyday life. I quote, You put your real life aside. You forget about your troubles. It doesn't matter if you are in love. It doesn't matter if your dad pressures you to work and bring money. This insurrectionary practice was unable to transform political structures, but it generated a fleeting space of freedom for young protesters insofar as it unfolded in the mode of play. In other words, the repetitive and transgressive nature of play was merged with the intensity of protest experience to generate a play world that freed the youth from the strictures of a daily life lived as a burden. I don't know, I have a few pages more. Should I just stop here because I was planning
maybe
to...
Maybe it would be good to stop here and maybe you can incorporate some of your remarks on self-defense in the Q&A part if there are questions addressing them. Thank you so much. So our second speaker is Sarah Hakyemez. So Sarah, it's your turn and you have 15 minutes as well.
Thank you for the... So I want to thank John for his kind invitation, kind introduction. And I also want to tell the ones who just joined us that Rukem was not able to make it today. And I will be making a presentation on the work that I'm currently doing. And this presentation will focus on the latest war in Turkey's Kurdistan, like Haidar's. And I will move us from the insurgency to the digital space where this insurgency was represented. And I will move us from Cizre to Diyarbakır. And I think there are some resonances between Haidar's analysis and mine. And maybe we will get a chance to talk about it during the Q&A. So let me start. Turkish security forces hit Diyarbakır by gunship helicopters, armored tanks, and troops for 100 days from December 2015 to March 2016. The heavy artillery targeted Sur, the oldest town of Diyarbakır, which served as a cultural tourism site for a brief period of time when the armed conflict between the Kurdish movement and the Turkish state had come to a stalemate in 2013 and 14. The ceasefire between the conflicting parties did not last long, though. Politically active Kurds, inspired by their counterparts in Rojava, established self-defense units in their inner neighborhoods to ignite an uprising for autonomy in Kurdish cities. Under the threat of losing territorial sovereignty, state-appointed governors declared indefinite curfews in these cities where security forces carried out sweeping military operations. The operation in Diyarbakır lasted the longest and attracted the attention of national and international media outlets. A large number of footages was uploaded to the digital space during the curfew in Sur. Turkish security forces recorded live what they called Flak 12 operation as they made advances from the other borders of Sur district to Suriçi. These recordings were broadcasted on mainstream news channels, uploaded to the online portals of newspapers, and shared on social media. Saturated with violence and reinforced by technological advancement, they expanded the battlefield to the digital space, where fear and terror were reinforced through viral circulation. It was not only the Turkish security forces who were involved in recording. Those witnessing the operation recorded on their smartphones what they considered grave human rights violations. If the recordings of security forces meant to recruit viewers to support state violence, the individual recordings of the latter attempted to show the tragic effects of that violence on the city and its residents. The digital space was thus crowded by three figures which not only countered but also reproduced each other: heroic Turkish soldiers, heroic Kurdish guerrillas, and innocent victims. The tension between these three figures is neither peculiar to the war in Turkey's Kurdistan nor reconcilable through its migration to the digital space. War images operate through scenic affirmation of sovereignty and scenic abnegation of enemy. Rather than disclosing a hidden truth, they conscript viewers into the trajectory of bullets and missiles by turning video cameras into the weapons of war, a phenomenon that Adi Kantsman and Rebecca Stein have labeled digital militarism. Situated within a vicious circle of verification and denunciation, heroic soldier, heroic guerrilla, and innocent victim gain traction within their own publics, devoid of evidentiary capacity to establish guilt or prove innocence. This paper is not interested in the truth value of these war images. It is rather interested in the production of the phantasmic through the montage of these images. By bringing together different elements, montage produces something extra, a surplus, that produces a state of generative instability, where each part transforms and takes on new shapes within the wider constellation. Among the images montage, this paper focuses on the diary of resistance in Sur. It examines the visual aesthetics, narrative structure, and the rhythm of the Diary of Resistance in Sur video to show how it pictures the specters of Kurdish fighters who disrupt this accelerated rhythm of social media by disclosing spatial and temporal discontinuities between the viewer and the viewed. I argue that in its commemoration of the dead, the surplus that this video produces speaks to the complicity of the viewers of this video in the tragedy that was depicted in it. The consumption of this surplus effect is contingent upon the aesthetic tools deployed and the pace in which the tragedy is represented. In the aftermath of the Sur operation, the Diyarbakir governor banned the public commemoration of dead guerrillas and forced their families to bury them at midnight outside of the city center. The Kurdish movement paid its dues to the approximately 70 guerrillas died in Sur through print, broadcast, and social media. At the center of commemoration activities lies a diary. At the center of commemoration activities lies a diary written amid the clashes. Upon his commander's request, an injured Kurdish fighter who went with the nom de guerre Hemgin Roj took the daily notes on a thin graph paper notebook, describing the debilitating conditions under which the guerrillas were fighting against the heavily equipped army and air forces of the Turkish state. Hemgin was killed on the last day of the Sur uprising, yet one of his friends was able to smuggle the diary out of the curfew site and bring it to the guerrilla headquarters in Iraqi Kurdistan. The Kurdish journalist Doğan Çetin acquired a copy of this diary to prepare it for publication and visualize commemoration. Diary, as a genre, often entails the disclosure of one's inner world to oneself and others. Although diaries written by Kurdish guerrillas for their personal archives could deploy an intimate and personalized voice, the ones written with the purpose of publication tend to have a documentary-like character, containing information about the precise dates and locations of armed confrontations, and full names and detailed memories of martyrs. Published guerrilla diaries are not necessarily stripped of all feelings, but rather concentrate on those that are felt collectively after an operation, ranging from thrill to sorrow to anger. Authorship in most of these diaries is considered to be collective, since the writing process involves many guerrillas, some of whom narrate their stories orally, while others transcribe them into diaries. The editors of Kurdish publishing houses and news media take the last cuts to give a final shape to such diaries. A selection of Hemye's diary entries was published in 5 parts in the Europe-based Kurdish journal Yeni Özgür Politika. In early September 2016, the major Kurdish news agency, DİHA, announced the upcoming diary series with the headline, "The Resistance Diary of Sur Meets Its Readers." Similar to other epistolary narratives, the diary as a medium of representation creates an illusion of presence that transforms the addressee from an absent figure into a presence which hovers in the text's interstices. Despite the time lag between Hemgin's writing of the diary and its meeting with readers, the letter is kept in lingering in the former's diary through the use of certain visual images and framing structures. A picture of the first page, let me keep this slide. A picture of the first page of the diary circulated on social media to reinforce a spatial contiguity between the writer and his potential readers. An illusion of temporal continuity was generated by editorial notes, which captioned the words of the late guerrilla commander of Sur, which says, "Whatever happens, the end will be glorious." While the published diary notes give insights into what had happened in Sur, the editor took up the task of showing that the end has indeed been glorious through his selection of headlines and subtitles, insertion of editorial notes and guerrilla pictures. This diary was made public not only in a written form, but also through a digital video. As opposed to the visuals produced by Turkish security forces, the producers of this visualized diary did not have close-up shots or drawn images that could open a new field of vision to represent Sur's ruination in an authentic fashion. Instead, they obtained from Kurdish journalists some footages about the operation, consisting of scenes of the Kurdish youth mounting barricades by piling up sandbags and paving stones and storing up light weapons for the upcoming war. The producers of this video combined these footages with the ones taken haphazardly by the residents of Diyarbakir on their smartphones, others recorded by CCTV cameras of Sur's shopkeepers, and those the police shot and shared on television channels. The diary video speaks from multiple perspectives, moving from that of Kurdish journalists to Diyarbakir residents to the police. There is neither temporal nor spatial contiguity between these shootings. Instead of using digital technologies to overcome abrupt transitions between those, the producers of this video highlighted the visual rupture by marking each transition with a drum backing. While serial drum beats emphasize the feeling of a rupture, a cacophony of multiple sounds embedded in the video conveys a sense of pulsating danger. As these sounds are mixed with each other, a trained anchorwoman's voiceover reads Hemgin's notes in a highly professional intonation and an Istanbulite Turkish accent. The juxtaposition of her distant voice recorded in a studio to the cacophony of noises emanating from the footages renders the disjuncture between the viewer and the viewed perceivable at the audio level. This misalignment of voice and sound not only casts doubt on the identity of the speaking subject, but also questions the capacity of the viewers to comprehend the war in its entirety. Montaging these images from different sources with their irreconcilable perspective, the video performs, first and foremost, the impossibility of having a full spectrum of war. While the written diary generates the illusion that readers meet those who fought in Sur, the visual diary reveals the illusion concealed in this meeting, namely the death of the referent. Drawing on Barthes' notion of the punctum, I suggest that this video wounds the viewer through the montage of images disclosing the sign's loss of the referent. The line of flight traced by a punctum enables the viewer to apprehend that which has been there but is no more. The producers of the diary, the video of the diary, wanted to convey the message of the guerrilla's immortality and the resistance victory. Although they evinced this intention by reproducing larger than life portraits of the guerrillas, like you can see here, the montage brings to the surface the lives and spaces lost in real time. In the video,
by the way, Sarah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. In this video, these portraits are projected onto the citadels and basalt stone walls of Sur. The camera guides viewers through the old streets of Sur, where they confront the superposed pictures of guerrillas who look as if they are guarding the streets. Yet, as the camera continues to move, the guerrillas who looked almost alive a second ago becomes still photographs. With each move, the camera leaves a guerrilla behind, only to run into another one. While these scenes convey a sense of recuperating what was lost in the war, the contrast between the stillness of the photos and the moving footage indicates that the recuperation promised in the written diary would soon be lost again in the visual one. Is it possible to conceive of this punctum of time and death as generative of a space of non-indifference that compels a different way of inhabiting social media? When the written and visual diaries were released, some Twitter users shared the internet links of these diaries. The video was later uploaded to YouTube, yet the commentary section was disabled to protect it from verbal attacks. The empty white page underneath the YouTube page can be seen as a forced silence, which may still direct the viewer's attention to the diegetic space of the diary, crowded with disrupting voices. The sharing of the YouTube video was further slowed down due to its length. Although the video was divided into 5 parts, the viewers would face legal sanctions if they shared it using their real names or downloaded it onto their cell phones or computers. Resisting the digital media's militant adherence to sharing, reproducing, and circulating images, the visual diary appears as though it was a product from the times of mechanical reproduction, claiming the current space of digitalization. This disjuncture between the diary's disengagement from the cultural aesthetics and digital speed of social media and its reproduction of the footages found on social media is what imbues this video with the potential to create a counter-hegemonic memory of war. I will end
here. Thank you so much, Sarah. So I turn to our discussant, Melissa Bilal.
Thank you, Sarah and Haydar. I find it meaningful to be the discussant of this panel that brings Sarah's and Haydar's researches together. Not only because I'm a citizen of Turkey myself, who does not quite fit into the official definitions of the Turkish national, and whose life has been defined by this position of being a suspect citizen in the eyes of the state, but also because as an Armenian, I represent the very identity, the denial of which the nation state has been constituted on. As a scholar conducting ethnographic and historical research on the impact of state and collective violence on my native community of Armenians in Turkey, I find situating my relationship with Sarah and Haydar's work significant because, first of all, I'm interested in problematizing the colonial relationships reproduced in anthropological practice in Turkey. Both papers urge me to address the question of politics of anthropological research on the populations that have been made vulnerable by the Turkish state. The first thing I want to point to then is the very nature of Sarah and Haydar's research. Being acquainted with the background of these works and the processes that shaped them, especially that of Haydar's as a colleague and a close friend, make me think about the ways in which the knowledge, anthropological knowledge we produce is in dialogical relation with the responses we developed as human beings within the political and emotional conditions we have been pushed in by the Turkish state. The second reason why I find commenting on these papers meaningful, but also rather traumatic for me, is that uneasy relationship between my lived experience and my scholarly work. As an Armenian of Istanbul, a descendant of genocide survivors from different parts of the Ottoman Empire, my presence here adds, I guess, another level to this discussion. While my citizenship has been defined by the epistemology of denial, during the formative years of my political self, the Kurdish critique to Turkish nationalism and sovereignty and their extension in cultural exclusionism and erasure has been crucial. Kurdish experience and political expression provided me and my generation of friends our very repertoire of protest. In the late 1990s, when I was getting organized with a group of Armenian women on Boğaziçi University campus, I was reading Kurdish feminist journals and using their formulations of being Kurdish and woman to give voice to my own position as a minority woman in Turkey. And in 2000s, when a neoliberal, imperialist, nostalgic, multiculturalist discourse started being fashioned in Turkey, especially targeting the non-Muslim communities, among many other things, it was the exclusion of Kurds from this discourse that provided me with the clarity of seeing how the borders of that culture talk were strongly sealed by nationalism. As we criticize neoliberal multiculturalism in Turkey, that had become a way of covering up for denialism and not working through the past in Turkey, we were further traumatized by the orchestrated racist murder of Hrant Dink, and later in 2013 and especially 2015-16, as Sarah explained, we found ourselves in a state where violence became the unreserved, unashamed response of the government to any attempt at coexistence and survival. In April 24th, 2015, I was in Diyarbakır Sur district for the 100th anniversary commemoration of the Armenian Genocide, where I witnessed perhaps the closest attempt thus far in Turkey to the recognition of the Armenian Genocide and genocide of Syriac and Greek peoples. In a public address by HDP leader Selahattin Demirtas, who is, as you know, now victim of unlawful imprisonment. A few months after the speech in April 2015, Sur was an urban war zone, as Sarah explained. Over the past 2 months, while witnessing the horrors of the war in Karabakh, Artsakh, from afar, I had flashbacks to the horrors of 2015, 2016. Besides, because of many obvious reasons, such as Turkey sending Syrian mercenaries to fight against Armenians, but also because of the rising ultra-nationalist pan-Turkish discourse in Turkey in response to the war, and I'm not discussing the similarities or differences between the two cases, Artsakh and the Kurdish war against Kurds, but focusing on Turkey's foreign policy. In my personal and political experience, from my standpoint, my situated knowledge resulting from my biography and my research, I had the immediate reaction of connecting Karabakh to northern Syria, especially the Kobani and Afrin resistances. As an Armenian historian, and through my research over the past decade, I came to learn the interconnectedness of Armenian and Kurdish histories, as well as the Kurdish memory of the Armenian genocide, both as perpetrators and as rescuers. I began to understand the connection between the Armenian genocide as the original unpunished crime and the unending cycle of violence that has been going on in Turkey from Dersim genocide of 37-38 to 6-7 September 1955 pogrom against non-Muslims, from the expulsion of Greeks 64-74 to 78 Maraş massacre, 1980 military coup, disappearing of political prisoners, to assassinated peace activists, from the full-scale military and police operations against Kurds to the near complete suppression of political dissent in Turkey today along class, ethnic, religious, gender, and sexual orientation lines. There's a growing literature on this relationship of cohabitation, conflict, domination, oppression, betrayal, and or peace and solidarity between Armenians and Kurds in the past. There is also growing work on the collective memory of places and people that manifest itself in songs and stories. The more I do research and learn about my own history, the more I can detect the historical continuities between strategies of Armenian and Kurdish self-defense, forms of struggle, genres of resistance. That's why Haydar's work also resonates with my work. I can see how the genocidal structure, to borrow native scholar Patrick Wolf's formulation, is constantly reminded to us by the state through unending violence to reaffirm its sovereignty. So the question I want to raise, and this is a question inspired by my conversation with Ruken last week, the question is this: where do we go wrong in fighting against a state apparatus that is constantly turning one population against the other by generating fear? And where do we fail in our attempts to build solidarity to dismantle this ubiquitous violence that shapes our past, present, and future in this post-Ottoman region, a region where Turkey's domestic and foreign policy has been that of destruction of populations it defined as enemies to its national sovereignty? And I'll leave it here.
Thank you so much, Melissa. So I'll turn to our speakers to see if they have any comments on our speakers' comments.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I forgot to unmute myself and Melissa was presenting, but thank you for your reflections, Melissa. I think your question is extremely important to think with, because I don't have any answer to it, but I think it's such an important question to ask. Like, where do we know how, I mean, we constantly analyze how the state, the mechanisms of violence that is inflicted by the Turkish state, but perhaps it's time to turn back to ourselves to ask, where do we fail? Where do we fail so badly that we keep seeing different episodes of the same violence? And I really like your question and your invitation to think about where do we fail? And perhaps in my presentation, I was just trying to say in a way that the whole idea of representing a war that is not representable can be a good way to start about this failure, because Haydar started with the beginning of this insurgency war, and I tried to explain how it was represented, but the representation itself was a failure, because it was inviting the viewers to feel like they are with the guerrillas who are already dead and who were asking for some help, but they couldn't get any help when the war was unfolding. So perhaps we should also think about the impossibility of representation and what comes afterwards, or what should be done when the entire apparatus of representation fails us.
Haydar, do you have anything?
Thank you very much, Melissa. I was actually going to mention that part, like why we fail to transform, you know, political structures. And I think relying on fetishized images is one of the deadlocks, I think, of political struggles today. You know, when you cannot really establish a revolutionary program, and you cannot really, create a different, a more radical, sociality, then you find yourself, just mobilizing, the people or through just this the true fetishes.
So we are coming to the end of our time. So I'll turn to Aslı and Ali for closing remarks. But before doing so, I want to personally thank you all for this great session. And thank you to all our conference participants and attendees.
Yeah, I'll echo John by thanking everyone who participated. And this, excellent second panel was really fantastic to participate or watch, to learn from, let's put it that way. I want ultimately to step away from this with a kind of positive idea. And I do think that you have really demonstrated that there's much to be recovered from this moment, even as it's also a moment to mark loss and tremendous both loss and trauma. But there are many things not just to be recovered, but to be built upon. And that's the beginning of a different conversation, I think, and maybe one we can think about in another phase. But it's really, it's been a great pleasure, everything we could have hoped for. And I'm just going to turn the floor finally to Ali Behzad to close us out.
Thank you very much. I cannot thank you enough for this wonderful panel. All these speakers were just, the presentations were great, Sarah's and Haydar's and Melissa's, Masood and Dilsa and Kayvon. And of course, the great leadership of both Jan and Asli in making this possible. And we're delighted actually to collaborate and to work with the Global Academy. We're very fortunate to be part of it. And I hope that this is just the beginning of a long conversation that we will have in the future. So please, let us stay in touch, and we look forward to having more discussions about these very important and timely discussions. So thank you all. Thank you all, the audience, for...
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Stonebrothers. Forced to go toe-to-toe, blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Stonebrothers. Vilified by all sides, vilified for small crimes. Forced to go blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Goliath. With one drink. We're gonna drink. We're gonna drink. Hasn't changed, same old monopoly, same couple players on all of the property. I ain't a prop, don't get no props to me, my people still don't need property. Think we forgot, we was just property, think we'll be bought again, think that they brought them democracy. I think they brought back them poppies, these my people locked up and chopping. That's hypocrisy, we wasn't thought of, we wasn't brought up and taught, we was set up, that's why we get caught up. Y'all discarded us, put them bars up, of course we got guards up, we hard cause we hard up. They got them startups and Starbucks, we got a couple of stars, so they turn them to starters, they starve us. Can't even drink water, up north with that Flint water, all in the sink cause they sink for the kids on the brink. Y'all went to Harvard and Stanford, think harder for answers, man, think. We're far below standards, don't tell me anger won't help us, you told me the cancer would shrink. We need to shrink, we just see boys making bands and sink. Open your eyes, my fam, we all could be gone in a blink. Game hasn't changed, same game of life we play. Maybe I'm only one roll of the dice away from a rose with some ice and some gold on the license plate.
to roll our whole life away. I think they gamed us, made us be gamers. They game with the system, they made it to play us. Gave us controllers, we gave no control up. The game wasn't made, so we make it, it's made up. It's war that they're waiting, just look at these wages they pay us. It's pennies, it pains us, they paint us in corners on corners. What can we do, man, we're cornered. I'm lucky I'm stuck in this booth, stuck here all cooped up. People get stuck up for loot, stuck up in bougie. What stuck us in jewelry, they cut us, stuck up for the youth. Stuck up for justice and truth. Now we can either get loud or just shut up and shoot. Give us a shot. Don't shut us out from the group. You can shut down the nuke. Don't push our buttons and suddenly y'all could go poof. Gone in a blink. Gone in a blink.